Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for March 16th, 2014. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, my co-host, Catherine Smith. Welcome, Catherine.
Hello, greetings from Atlanta.
Yes, and later on, probably just any minute, David Mark of Politics with us with an X.com is going to join us. David's been on multiple times and agreed to join us here in a little bit, and him being out of that Pacific time zone, I'm sure that kind of throws things off, because I know he's based out of San Francisco now. So we'll have him joining us real quick. But until then, let's start off with a little Georgia talk, since we don't have David, and you and I live in the state, so it's kind of near and dear to our heart. We might want to think ourselves experts of the states more so than others. There was a poll that came out by Insider Advantage. I believe Channel 11 was involved. That's the NBC affiliate in Atlanta, for those who are not familiar with Atlanta TV. Morris News Service, which is owner of several of the papers, including the Augusta, Georgia paper, they all pitched in to have this poll commissioned. So it wasn't just, you know, let's put 2,000 or let's poll 200 people and, you know, throw this thing out real quick, just have something on Insider Advantage's site. They actually had to, I think, you know, increase the universe and get more folks involved so it would be a paid, you know, reputable poll. So anyway, they put this thing out there, and it showed that right now, according to this poll, Jason Carter would have 41% of the vote, and Nathan Deal, incumbent governor, would only get 38. 21% of the vote was undecided. Catherine, I will say floored by this, but I would say if you told me there was a poll coming out, pick the numbers, I would not have picked Jason Carter in the lead. I would not have picked the incumbent governor Republican in Georgia at this point, only 38%. How surprised were you by these numbers?
I was surprised by the numbers. I thought they would be – I mean, they're really close because it's a – like 4 point, what is the word? What's the phrase? What's the 4 point? It's a
the margin of error.
Margin of error. God, I couldn't remember that phrase. I'm getting old. So it's really close, and I expect it to be close, but I would have expected it to be close, both in the 40s. I think that the incumbent governor being under 40% is really stunning for a, you know, for a red state like Georgia, for the incumbent Republican governor without any, I mean, he's got the two opponents in the primary, but I don't think anyone really thinks that there's much of a chance that he won't win the primary. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that, but I think he's got a pretty good chance of winning the primary. I found that under 40% stunning.
Yeah, I think now we, of course, would like to see a primary poll, because if this many, because we know the Republican baseline is somewhere in the mid-40s. I mean, pretty much a Republican puts his name on the ballot, her name on the ballot in recent elections, he or she gets 45% of the vote just for being on the general election ballot. So that
I think it's even higher than that, don't you? I think it's 50%, 51%.
Well, if you look at when we have an incumbent like, say, Tommy Irvin, Michael Thurman, Thurber Baker in 2006, we could probably point to some places where, you know, I mean, I'm just talking on any circumstances, they're going to get 45%, which is an incredible baseline to start with. So this means Nathan Deal is getting at least, we'll say if Catherine's right, it's even more, but at least he's underperforming his party by 7% at this point, which is a pretty significant number. I would like to see the crosstabs here. I want to see who these undecided voters are, because it's my sneaking suspicion that in Georgia today, and a lot of independents are voters that vote 80% of the time Republican, you know, and that's every race down to county clerk and their local county. And so, therefore, it may just be that a lot of these voters are going to end up voting Republican, you know, these undecideds, 8 out of 10, and at this moment in time, this will be a little fool's gold. But the good thing for Jason Carter is he can take this number out and really, I think, fundraise off of it, you know, lock up more substantial support. If this kind of becomes a chink in the armor to Nathan Deal, maybe it creates an opening that two of these candidates and his primary can exploit, which will damage him for, you know, the general election. This is definitely not good news for Nathan Deal, and it definitely is good news for all three of Nathan Deal's challengers. It's just what they do with it. This poll within itself, you know, it's not magic beans. It doesn't win you an election. But it'll be interesting to see how everybody responds. Have you heard any news out of particularly Jason Carter's camp about this poll?
I have not. I saw Senator Carter on Wednesday, but that was long before this came out. And he was working at the Capitol, so he wasn't talking about his election. And I didn't ask him about it.
Yeah, and that's probably the thing that a lot of them have to do, be it John Barge, Jason Carter, Nathan Deal, they all have to take care of their job at the Capitol while the session's going on, and then, of course, even John Barge after that, because schools...
only two more days of the session, so...
Yeah, crazy enough in the past few years, that's just been a good thing, if the session's quick, because they can do less damage.
Thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately as far as the governor's race is I think it's going to be really interesting, the visuals are going to be interesting whenever they do a debate. Because, you know, Jason is very energetic and, you know, obviously very young, he's fresh-faced, you know, he's got all his hair, and he wears a suit very well, he looks good. And, you know, Nathan Deal, I mean, all three of the other guys are older, and I think that those visuals are going to be, they may be very compelling, and they may have an impact on this. You know, the younger independent voter may find themselves identifying with a younger, more enthusiastic, more energetic candidate when they see them, in action, so to speak.
Yeah, and the trick will be is actually getting people to turn on Channel 8 or Channel 30 at 6 o'clock on a Sunday to watch the debates. But I think you're right. There'll still be news clips. There'll be radio ads. I think you could even hear the difference in those two men's voice and who they are. Well, let me go ahead right now and break away from this and welcome onto the show. Welcome back to the show, David Mark of Politics.com. Welcome, David.
Hello.
Hey, welcome back to the show, David Mark.
Well, this is not David Mark. I was just calling in to add some comments. So,
great.
You put me on hold.
Oh, okay. Well, go ahead. All right. We were talking about the Georgia governor's race, and what you got?
Oh well, I'm in Pennsylvania, so I don't know if I'm the best person you want to have on.
Okay.
I did want to add some general political comments and about. I think the thing going on right now in Ukraine is pretty damn important, and I really am hoping for and wishing for some peace candidates or for some common sense to prevail, because it looks like at worst we're going to get Cold War 2.0 with Russia and China, or at best, and at worst it could be something much worse. And I've been not surprised, but I've been very cognizant of the fact that there's no real difference in foreign policy. The anti-war peace activists that were left-wing from the left wing when Bush was in office that were criticizing the war in Iraq, as soon as Obama got elected, they went into witness protection. And now we're not only having problems with the Middle East, but we're threatening a new Cold War with Russia, which I think is far more dangerous than anything we've done in the Middle East, because Russia is a nuclear power. They're a more powerful country than these tenuous dictatorial regimes in the Middle East. And I think if we're not careful, and if we don't look beyond being Republicans or Democrats and actually fight for something, we're going to find ourselves in a significantly more dangerous world than even the one that we've been in since after 9/11.
Yeah, I think I did see some polling that a lot of Americans, you know, they have no interest in going back to the Cold War mentality. I don't know that Americans would ever go back to that mentality again, because it's almost like, you know, we spent, you know, nearly 50 years locked in this mindset of they're evil just because they're evil. And then there ended up not being as much there as we thought. And then now for, I guess, over 20 years, we just don't worry about Russia nearly as much as we did before, which I think, I guess, in some ways creates a healthier mindset for both countries, that we're not just in, you know, living in some state of fear. I mean, I came along a little after the time they were, you know, they would do, you know, nuclear bomb drills in schools and whatnot. But, you know, I know people of a generation ahead of me remember that a lot more clearly. Catherine, what's your thoughts on the new Crimea-Russia foreign policy issue?
Well, it concerns me, you know, for much of the same reasons that our caller mentions. I don't see any chance of electing any peace-loving candidates in the next, in the 2014 or 2016 cycles. The best we can hope for is to be able to influence the candidates and the elected influence the elected officials that we already have. It's a rigged game. I mean, I hate to say that, but it really is. I mean, with gerrymandering and the financial and economic parts of the elections, there's just not a candidate. I mean, I can't think of a candidate that could penetrate those barriers and succeed. So the answer is to, you know, spend a lot of time and a lot of effort talking to your elected officials, going to Washington if you can, going to your state, to them when they're in their state offices, if that's the best opportunity, and talking to them. I'm telling you that they like to hear from you. And the more they hear from people, the more impact it has. That's my opinion.
Yeah, and if you think about the Cold War, when there was wars, it was fighting over Korea. Both sides were in the back, and then Vietnam, and then some other places. But there was never any direct fighting over any part of the old Soviet Union, you know, direct fighting like that. And so I don't know now that if there was a hot war, if you will, not a cold war, this would be directly a place that was part of the old Soviet Union. And I just don't see the scenario where that would happen now, you know, 20-plus years, you know, in between the end of the Cold War and this action. So, I mean, it just seems like a pretty big jump, and I don't think either President Obama or, you know, your average mainstream Republican candidate, for that matter, that if they were to become president, or Hillary Clinton or anybody else you name, would then get involved in a hot war with Russia over old USSR land. Caller, and you feel free to tell us your name. Do you think that's the case?
Well, my name's Brian. I think to the American people over the last 20 years, I think the American people in our country haven't thought a lot about it, but unfortunately we're not the ones making decisions. And what I've noticed is, and I mean, it's been written about, Bush 1, Clinton, Bush 2, and Obama have continued to expand NATO. And the whole thing with the Ukraine was over a couple things. Number one, that president, Ukraine's in financial trouble. And he had an offer of a bailout package, well, not a bailout, a loan package from the IMF, which would have meant a double barrel of Greek-style austerity, where you take the loan, but then you got to cut your spending, your programs, raise taxes, and people in your country have to take a big haircut, about 30 to 50%. He took a loan from the Russians, which was much more generous instead. So that made the, whether you want to call them the Anglo-American establishment, the New World Order, or whatever, the oligarchy, it made them very angry, and he didn't want to join NATO. And it seems to me the goal is to, they want to maintain that unipolar world which existed after the Soviet Union collapsed in 91, which meant America was the last superpower left standing, and they wanted the rest of the world to be aligned with America. Now, if you want to be nice, you can say what they wanted is they wanted to maintain the ability to police the rest of the world and spread democracy. Me, I'm more skeptical, and I think they wanted to create that new world order slash empire. And what's happened is, as Russia and China and, you know, the BRICS have been emerging, they're a threat to that unipolar world. I mean, never forget, whatever you think of Putin, if it wasn't for Putin this past September, we would have gone to war with Syria. But because Putin put his foot down, and to a lesser extent China, and then that war, the vote in England went the other way, we didn't go to war with Syria. And I'm convinced if we had gone to war with Syria directly, which we nearly did, the next domino to fall would have been Iran. And the thing is, it's like as Russia and China become more powerful, the unipolar world doesn't exist. Other countries are aligning with other superpowers, and that's traditionally been the way the world works. But unfortunately, the people that run our country, and I have a more cynical view, but I think it's based in fact, they don't like that. You know, they like to be able to control other parts of the world. And I don't think they're going to be satisfied until the Ukraine, looks like they are going to accept it, but they not only accept the IMF austerity package and turn themselves into Greece, but they also join NATO. So if they join NATO, they're going to join NATO, which means they'll be backed by nuclear weapons and a war guarantee from America and right on Russia's borders, and Russia is a superpower with nuclear weapons. I think that presents a very dangerous situation, especially when, I mean, it's just abundantly clear. You can watch the YouTube video and the tapes of Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State, saying that they've spent $5 billion funding the two factions to, quote-unquote, support democracy in Ukraine. And then there's that tape of her talking about how, you know, who they want to install in the puppet regime. And so they've put Putin in a situation where he has to defend himself. If he lets Crimea go, he's going to lose a critically important military base. And he's going to have NATO all the way into Crimea. And if he lets him go, my thing is the next thing they'll do, the State Department, CIA, they'll spend another $5 billion fomenting a coup or some kind of a color revolution in Russia. So I think, and to me it's my critiques bipartisan, but I think the people we have running this country are dangerous enough to where things can spiral out of control, because you can try to control everything and you can put in puppet governments and such, but we've seen in the Middle East that, you know, sometimes you have unintended consequences happen. And I do think it's dangerous because I think, again, the people making decisions I don't think are thinking rationally the way you might be thinking or the way you might assume most people think. And I think this is something where if we can't put aside our prejudices and we can't just stop being, you know, and we're always going to be good Republicans and Democrats, well, be very careful about what kind of world you wake up in tomorrow, which could be a much more dangerous world. So I am very suspicious. And just look at the way our media, left and right wing, whether it's the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, talk about Russia. I mean, they talk about Putin as if he's Joseph Stalin. I mean, if you just pay attention closely, I mean, you'll see where we're headed and what direction we're being pushed in. I don't think the people in this country want it.
Can I just interrupt you for a second? No, it's okay. I recognize your passion and I understand what you're saying. But what do you, I mean, you can talk like this all day, but what is the solution?
Well, I think
you
made a good
point. What path do you see that we can change it?
Well, I think you
in any productive way.
Well, you made a good point. I mean, I think making phone calls and having your voices heard makes a big difference. I mean, when you flood the lines with calls and melt the phone lines or meet with your leaders in Washington or go to town halls, I mean, they do respond to that. Now, some of them, you're going to laugh at me for saying this, but I really do think some of these people are sociopaths. They don't care, and once they're out of a job, they got a nice, you know, cushy six-figure job waiting for them. But I think a lot of these people do want to keep their jobs, and even if they do the right thing for the wrong reasons, you can get them to do the right thing if there's enough pressure.
I just want to say that, you know, I've talked to a lot of congressmen and senators in my life, and I think that the majority of them want to do the best work they can. I think there's some that are, like you said, you know, they're just waiting for, you know, they're just wanting the job and, you know, waiting for their, you know, big payout when they leave. But I think that is a very small portion. I think most of them, you might not agree with them. You might not, and I'm not saying that I agree with them, but I think they go into work every day wanting to make, wanting to be, you know, make this country as strong and as prosperous and as equal and safe as they can. And it really bothers me when people draw this big, you know, swath of everyone's in it because they want to keep their job. I just don't think that's, I don't think there's a lot of validity in that argument. I think that if they, if that's what they wanted, they would leave. It's not that great a job.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
and Brian,
like
I'll tell you one thing. I guess if you look at history, you had from Harry Truman through Ronald Reagan, I guess, to the start of George H.W. Bush's term. You had a lot of politicians, both parties, and some of those further to the right than others. And we never went to war with Russia. I mean, you know, I don't know why a new leader in a new day would be more eager to do that when, you know, Ronald Reagan wasn't, when, you know, Richard Nixon wasn't, Dwight Eisenhower, who was general during World War II. I mean, he kept us out of any kind of hot war with Russia. So I don't know why now would be that much different.
Especially when you look at the economic... at the economic, that we're all so connected economically now that I think it's really, I mean, I think that, you know, we can talk about China, but China's not going to do anything to harm the economic relationship they have with the United States. They might fuss around a little bit. They might, like, pose a little bit, but ultimately they're tied to us economically, and we're tied to them. It's both ways, and same with Europe.
Well, may I add a comment then?
Sure.
I mean,
final comment, then
what
we'll
you're
move
saying.
On.
I mean, and you can. There were numerous times where it could have gotten hot. You know, Kennedy defused the Cuban Missile Crisis. You had the uprisings in Hungary in the 50s. You had things happen in Poland, I think, in the 80s. And, you know, it only went so far. But, you know, we went to war with Serbia or Kosovo in 99, Afghanistan 01, Iraq 03, bombing Libya, bombing Pakistan. Bombing Oman and all other kinds of countries in the Middle East. I mean, we've
done
an awful
war.
We've engaged in quite a few wars and a lot of military type action and coups over the last 15 years. And some of them aren't hot wars, but you know, for example, the thing in Ukraine, it's just a fact. I mean, it was a U.S. backed coup. Now, no weapons were fired, and we didn't send troops over there, but it was a coup. And I just don't, you know, if you're going to say that most of these people are good, then how can these people be interfering in the affairs of other nations that don't affect us strategically, you know, and continue to do it over and over and over again?
Good's a value judgment, and I know she never said good. I just meant get involved in war directly. I mean, that point of no return in which somebody, you know, gets involved in a war that can lead to nuclear war. None of the leaders between the end of World War II and when Gorbachev, you know, came to be and came into power, and then perestroika and all that that caused the Cold War to kind of end, all during that time, no one on either side pushed it to that breaking point. They always worked through places. I guess the closest would have been Cuba, which you mentioned. Well, Brian, we thank you for calling in. But, I mean, one thing I will tell you about our show is we're kind of a Southern politics show. And sometimes we'll reach out of the South, but you brought it. That's okay. You brought us further out of the South than ever. I mean, every once in a while we'll talk about Canada or something like that. But definitely Crimea and the Soviet Union and the Ukraine, we definitely broaden our horizons. We appreciate you listening and call anytime.
Well, thanks. And, hey, I mean, I hope you two are the ones that are right about this issue, and I'm the one that looks like a fool. I'll be more than happy to look that way. I just think, again, I'm just looking at the last 15 years of history, and it just seems like we don't know when to leave well enough alone. And, you know, we got enough problems here at home with our economy. You know, I think you remain a great country by having a strong economy. you get involved in too many wars, you end up like those empires in Europe that perished after the first two world wars. So, but I hope you're right. And I'm not saying I think it's going to be a hot war, but I think at the very least we're going to end up with the Cold War. It just seems like, you know, we're not thinking about this. We have people in Washington that aren't thinking rationally and that are beating the drums. And again, before I let you go, I'll just say, pay attention to the media coverage and the way they demonize Putin. Not a saint, but not Stalin, but they would make you think that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, okay.
Well,
we'll keep on tabs on that. Thank you again. Okay. We're going to bring it
back to
America.
Well, that was a little diversion. A little distraction
there. It was, but you know what? He was actually on a real issue that is important. If you look at Blog Talk Radio, there's probably shows that cover international politics exclusively. And, you know, we hope people listen to more shows besides our own, because we know people probably listen to other shows. And then somehow we come up in their feed and they try us out and hopefully they like
us
some. But
great.
We like to take callers and I didn't. It was funny. I recognized that area code, but didn't put it together that it was not the West Coast. That it was Pennsylvania, because I've actually had clients in Pennsylvania at times. But thanks again for Brian calling in. Well, I guess let's talk about the most recent election. It almost seems anticlimactic now that we've talked about the Cold War and everything else. But this past week on Tuesday, the special election, which we discussed in the past with Greg King, Alex Sink faced David Jolly. Everything pointed to this seat in Tampa Bay going in the Democratic column for the first time in quite a while, because President Obama, the gubernatorial candidate, Bill Nelson, the senator down there, every Democrat had been winning this district. Alex Sink is considered a popular candidate. She decided not to run for governor because this looked like a layup. I won't call it a slam dunk, but it looked like one she could win. She did not. Catherine, I'll just be honest. This thing has me worried, because this is the kind of race, if we can't win, it's kind of that off-year election turnout issue, you know, come to pass. I think it's a harbinger, if you will. What did you make of this election?
Well, I got to say, I was pretty surprised. I think a lot of people were surprised. I think we were, I don't want to say we were counting on it, but I think people were, you know, very optimistic about Alex Sink winning that race. And, you know, it looks like a turnout problem, which is always our off-year problem that we can't seem to overcome, is this problem that we have with people who always want to come out and vote for the president and then, you know, don't come out the 2 years later to give the president a Congress and a Senate that they can work with. So I disagree that it was all about Obamacare. I don't think that that's what this was about. I think it was
the polls are starting to turn. The health care plan is not near as controversial as we'll make it out to be. I think the hardcore Republicans don't like it, but swing voters are starting to warm up to it in a big way. There was a poll showing actually a majority want to keep it in some form or fashion, just maybe minor changes, if you will. But I think it is this turnout issue. I mean, Alex Sink, she lost by 2 points, only got 1% of the vote. David Jolly got 48. Now, I guess we have to ask the question, because Alex Sink seems to – she's lost, I guess. This is her third big election. How much of this is her as a candidate, and how much of this is just bad timing?
Well, you have to start to question her ability as a candidate, because, like you said, this is the third time. And this seemed like, you know, I mean, it seemed like the election that she should have been able to win. It was her district. Everyone thought that, you know, this was the perfect, you know, sort of perfect opportunity for her. And, you know, at some point you just begin to ask, is there something about her? I mean, and I don't know what it is. I've never met her. I've never even seen her speak. I might have seen a little clip of her on TV or something. But is there some flaw that we don't recognize? I mean, is it just that they don't elect women in that part of Florida? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't want to put all the blame on her. I do think it is the turnout issue. And then becomes the question, who's to blame for the turnout issue? And I think at some point, Democrats have to look at the man in the mirror, and then the woman in the mirror, and here's the problem. A lot of the folks that sit around and ponder these kind of questions are folks like you and I that turn out all kinds of time. I mean, if they would have let us vote five different times on five different days in five different weeks, you and I would have been there. But there's other people in our party that just, there is like dragging them out tooth and nail, whereas the Republicans do have an advantage in that their voters are very regimented in that, okay, it's an election, you show up, it's just your civic duty. What do we have to do? Do we either have to try to get some of those voters from the other party that see voting as a regimented civic duty, or do we try to get more of our people to believe that it's a regimented civic duty and change their ways? Because I'll be honest, Catherine, I'm not so sure that getting Republicans to switch to be Democrats, not all, but just a sliver of the more moderate ones, might be easier than getting some of our folks to show up on a consistent basis, because this is a chronic issue for off year election after off year election.
Well, I think that both are a huge challenge. I think that it would be hard to count on moderate Republicans to come out and vote for Democrats. I think that would be one of those, if we spend a lot of time encouraging them to vote, what if they change their mind when they get to the ballot box or the voting booth?
That's what I'm saying. I'm talking about the voters. You know these people are going to show up every single time. They're coming one way or the other. If they come and they vote for you, it's a twofer. One off of them, one for you. And so, I almost think that would be the strategy. Go ahead and try to find these voters that are persuadable on some issues but do have that incredible voting record that they show up for primaries, runoffs, generals. And try to pick some of those off.
I think, honestly, we have to do both. We have to figure out a way to convey to this rising – I mean, I think what we're looking – it's mostly young people that don't vote in the off years. So we have to somehow appeal to this rising American electorate that voting is – we vote almost every year, in city elect, you vote every other year in the odd number years in Atlanta, and then we need you to vote all the time. I think there are a lot of smart people working on this sort of compelling argument and trying to, this persuasion of this rising American electorate, and I'm hopeful that they have some tricks up their sleeves and ideas that will, convey the importance. We also have to try to convince those people who, in my mind, are voting against their best interests to come over to the light and vote for Democrats.
Conversion. I'll tell you, a few years back, I was at a political meeting, and some of us talk about turnout, and the guy goes, hey, what we need to do is offer a lot of these voters more trinkums. Still not exactly sure what a trinkum was, but I literally heard the word trinkum. I think I know what a trinkum is, but you know what? I should need to give you a trinkum for coming out to vote. You need to come out and vote because it's your civic duty. And I think there's a lot of that kind of thought, like, hey, if you vote, what can you do for me? Well, I mean, I can give you good government. I can, invest more and issue A, B, and C. But I'm not going to give you something at that moment.
I think the thing that is so important that has been lost. I think it's partly because of national media and less local media, that where it's really happening for your ordinary citizen is in the city halls and state capitals. That's where all the things that really have an impact on your day-to-day life, that's where it's happening. It's not happening in, I mean, some of it's happening on Capitol Hill in Washington, but most of the things that really have an impact on your day-to-day life are happening in the state legislatures and the city halls and county commissions. And I think that's the message that we need to ring home to our voters.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's really hard because, it's so complicated. You know, I've been at the Capitol, three or four days a week for the whole session. And it is, very confusing, a lot of the way the bills are written, the way the legislation comes across. It's really hard to figure it out. And nobody's really, certain organizations are watching it very close, and some of the television and radio does okay with it, but people aren't really paying attention, I don't think. I talk to people all day long, and they're like, oh, I didn't know about that bill, or I didn't, you and I were talking about it before we went on the air about some bills that you hadn't heard of, and you're, very well informed. So imagine the people that aren't informed at all. They watch the news and they see the things happening in Washington and they think that's where it's happening, but that's not really where it's happening. It's happening here.
Oh yeah,
in your backyard.
Legislation at the state level, coverage of that level of government has really declined in recent years. The locals still get some coverage because it sometimes is quirky. Of course, the federal gets coverage. That middle band gets left out, and that's kind of a sad thing because your state government is very, very important to each individual state. Well, on this, I do think that somebody's got to look at this race and see who turned out, who didn't, where did that lead, so to speak, go, figure out which groups it was, and then figure out who can get a hold of those folks and get them, out to the polls in 2014, because I do think if something doesn't change, the Senate will be lost. There will be some governor's races, including our own in Georgia, that might have changed but won't. The House will get further away from us, and you're going to then pretty much just forget the last 2 years of the Obama presidency, because as far as anything he can do, he'll just be holding the line on any kind of craziness the Republicans come up with, and that's probably going to play into the first 2 years at least, because it'll kind of take two cycles of the next president's term, which, I still assume will be Hillary Clinton, but then if it were to be a Republican, they would have such majorities, no telling what they could do, anything that the president, not only President Obama, but President Clinton did, they would have the majorities and their parties even further to the right than it was under Bush, that they could do no telling what. So it's pretty important. Somebody's got to work to figure this out. We're not really getting to a lot of topics, so I'm going to make sure we hit the highlights, Catherine, in this last 20 minutes.
Okay.
This past week in South Carolina, a Senate candidate in the primary for South Carolina's U.S. Senate seat, the senior Senate seat, we'll call it, Dave Feliciano, he was of Spartanburg, and he's probably the most minor of the candidates, according to the Columbia newspaper. He said, "It's about time South Carolina says, hey, we're tired of this ambiguously gay senator from South Carolina. We're ready for a new leader to merge," and I'm assuming it means emerge, "from the Republican primary. We're done with this. This is what it's all about, all is coming together and saying one way or another we're going to get on the ballot and get this guy in November." There's been a lot of rumors a lot of years about Lindsey Graham and his sexual orientation. I don't know. If I just said something about it, I'd be just talking nonsense because I have no clue. I don't know who he dates, who he likes, none of that. But the audacity of this fella to, in some ways, I guess you'd say out, although he may not be outing at all, he may just be telling lies, to say this, how desperate was this guy's, I guess, my first question. And then my second question is, Do you think this will have any traction, any resonance in the primary?
Well, I had never heard this rumor before, so I don't know where I've been. Apparently, I've been hiding under a rock or something, never heard that, because I usually hear these rumors. I think it's a sign of desperation. I'm not even sure what it means. And why does it matter?
I think it's referred to Saturday Night Live skit, the ambiguously gay duo. That may be why he chose that word.
I don't know, I'm just guessing. I just think giving him any kind of attention about this is, you know, bad form. The guy's obviously a loser. I mean, if you're going to talk about something about the election, I mean, talk about why he's such a bad senator, if you think he's a bad senator. What does his sexual orientation have to do with anything?
Well, I mean, this is a Republican primary, and this is a Republican primary in South Carolina, a very socially conservative state. I mean, this is a state where at one time a lot of social conservatives thought if they could pick one state to all move to where they could kind of take over, they had actually looked at South Carolina. They thought it already had some foundations, if you will, and then also it had a small enough population that they could really.
Well, how long has Lindsey Graham been a senator?
I think he's finishing his second term, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
he has been a congressman before that. Now, if you will look, this Dave Feliciano on his website has a drop-down issue, homosexual relations and the state role. This is a guy that, I mean, homosexuality is this big issue for him. And maybe because of these rumors, he's so affronted that's one of the reasons he ran, maybe. Because it seems to, I mean, he has very hardline right-wing views, it seems like, on
well, he's going to be, you know, he's going to be in the shadow of history very shortly.
Yes,
because
I agree.
It might not be that way in South Carolina soon, but I mean, I think that, you know, it's well past time that we were focused on these ridiculous, you know, bigotry. It's ridiculous.
You're right. The sun set on that. But listen to these guys' issues. Okay, this is in order. This is this fellow's issues. Religion, school security, Citizens Training Academy. That's basically deputizing the populace
militia
to fight crime. Yes, race relations, and it says right here, this is in bold caps, first sentence. I am not a politically correct senator. You're right. You're not a senator. You want to be one. And if you do not want to be offended, I suggest you not read any further. Basically, on race relations, he said, look, I'm probably fixing to be racist, is what he's saying. And then it says abortion, homosexual relationships, national security, illegal immigration, U.S. candidate stands by his statement, and that's not even an issue. So basically, this guy doesn't have economy, education, job creation, health care. Hey, he didn't even have taxes. He's a Republican. He's not even running on taxes. I'm shocked. I mean, pretty much almost all of this guy's issues are religious right, social conservative issues that this guy's running on. The funny thing is, though, is even if, like some people said, oh, man, I mean, we're talking right-wing folks in South Carolina, the Republican primary, said, yeah, I don't know. I've heard these rumors, and these must be true since old Dave's saying it out loud. I don't think he would be the beneficiary. One of the other opponents, like Nancy Mace or Lee Bright or Richard Cash, are probably more likely to benefit from the fact that he brought this thing up. And I will tell you, I have heard that rumor before. We have never discussed it on the Kudzu Vine because it was a rumor, and I'm actually not discussing the rumor. I'm discussing old Dave bringing it up. You know, that's kind of how it got, you know, he kind of took the rumor out of the closet if you will, by bringing it up. But I don't think Dave looks like a winner here. I think Dave looks kind of petty.
Petty and,
you know?
Backwards.
Yeah, I think you're right. And as I look, I love this. A guy named Det Bowers, who was a pastor, attorney, and an ex-Democratic state chair, is running for that same Senate seat as a Republican. He ran the Democratic Party at one point and now is a Republican, if you will. But the craziest thing is the guy, when you click on his website, it says Iron Man Outdoors. It has nothing to do with his campaign.
Oh, I love that.
So,
well, you know, recently, I don't know if you saw this, you know, I'm bringing this back to Georgia. Recently, one of the news people in Georgia asked Nathan Deal if he voted for President Carter back in 1976 when he was a Democrat.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, well, I can't remember, but I probably did.
Well, at least he's honest. I mean, that's good. I like it. I mean, he was a Democrat. I mean,
right.
You know,
oh, yeah.
Hopefully he voted for President Clinton, too. That was the thing. They, you know, Sonny Perdue and endorsed President Clinton as late as 96. you know, a lot of these, you know, these party switchers, they were not pure. It'll be interesting to see when the Republicans, the better hurry up and do it soon because the Georgia's shifting, when they will elect a tried and true Republican that's not a turncoat, if you will, like Nathan Deal. You know, they better do it soon because, you know, Georgia's going to switch on them, and then it's going to be a real dogfight for them to win. You know, it'll be a real election, I think, for a while. It'll be a purple swing state kind of thing, and maybe they will elect a real Republican, but it's kind of funny. They've had 12 straight years of party switchers.
Not
one of their guys that rose up through the ranks like a Newt Gingrich or a Matt Towery or a Earl Earhart. I mean, we can keep going on. They need to think about that. Well, let's talk about the Los Angeles Times wrote an article about Milledgeville, Georgia, and the U.S. Senate race. But talking about turning Georgia blue and the Michelle Nunn's campaign and how she's making her way around. I know in Time magazine they had a picture of her and her husband, and it was about this race, among others, and how important it is to the whole map. Michelle Nunn's getting a lot of national attention. Strangely enough, I'm not so sure she's not getting more national attention than she is Georgia attention. Catherine, do you think that's an accurate statement, or and if so, do you find that strange?
I think she's getting a fair amount of Georgia attention. I think it's hard right now because whatever local attention is on the, you know, nightly news is about the legislature, because there's been a lot of, you know, hot topics at the legislature, and they have been covering them. You know, I see those guys down there every day, and so I'm sorry, I just had a little snafu over here. But she is getting some attention. There's a fair amount of at least activity, you know, on Facebook and in social media with people, you know, trying to get people to volunteer for a campaign and, you know, pushing her message out there. So I think she's getting – but she is getting a lot of national attention, and I think that's good. I think that, you know, hopefully it's generating some, you know, campaign contributions from across the country to people who would like to see a Democrat get elected in the South. So that's all good.
Yeah. I know that Better Georgia did a poll on that Senate race. They did it, I guess, more of the poll was the Republican primary, and then they did have some head-to-head matchups. But, Catherine, you know, we asked about who we thought was going to go be where in the primary, and I thought Karen Handel was doing quite well, and I said, show me a poll otherwise, and like the next day we get this poll. I do think she's doing better than this poll, though. Paul Brown has 27%. The next closest challenger is Phil Gingrey at 14, Jack Kingston at 13, David Perdue at 12, Karen Handel at 9. They didn't even include Art Gardner or Derek Grayson in the survey. I guess David Yu had already dropped down so it didn't matter about him. He didn't get included. I guess that still leaves a decent number of undecideds. But I looked at some of the crosstabs that, like, 43% of the folks in this poll favored President Obama, 49 voted for Mitt Romney. That sounds like that was actually a little harsher against Democrats. But when they did the head-to-head matchups, Michelle Nunn leads Kingston, Handel, and Gingrey, and they didn't test Nunn and Perdue. And then Nunn and Brown were at a 38-38 deadlock. This is a pretty promising poll for two reasons. One, I think Paul Brown is probably the candidate that Michelle Nunn would like to face most. And then if you look at the actual head-to-head numbers, it's a pretty good deal for Michelle Nunn as well. But once again, a poll doesn't elect anybody, certainly not a March poll.
Right.
Did you see these numbers and what do you think?
I actually didn't look at them in close up, but I'll still talk about them. I think that's good news for Michelle Nunn. I am frankly not very surprised. I think Paul Brown is surprisingly the guy that, you know, he's the red meat candidate that their base is going to support in the primary. The question is going to be, can we get our people out? This is in November. Can we get our people out, and can we persuade the moderates to either stay home or come out and vote for Michelle Nunn and Jason Carter?
Yeah, and Paul Brown, I don't know if he has a plan, like maybe his advisors have a plan to make him look more moderate. I know this is always the situation where Tim and I would always disagree. I basically say, look, I want the best opponent for me that I can beat. And Tim, of course, would be like, well, you might end up with this person serving, and usually I look at the voting record, even if they are crazier sounding. I mean, even Johnny Isaacson probably votes with the Republican right 95% of the time. So I'm willing to take my chances on getting the whole thing instead of that 5% where that more rational Republican might agree with me. But I just think this is the one she would have the best chance at. I really, once again, I would love to see the crosstabs on this thing. I know Tom Jensen said he'd be on our show in 2 weeks from tonight, and so maybe we can get a early look at that thing so we can really ask him about it. I do know that he did some other polling in Georgia at the same time that he did release, like Hillary Clinton is competitive in Georgia. He did some of that miscellany, which I hadn't gone all the way through, but I did think that was interesting that it showed that Hillary Clinton was doing well. Also, his poll showed that Nathan Deal was stronger than the other poll showed, so those kind of conflicted, if you will.
You're gonna see those conflicts now because it really depends on, you know, how you're phrasing the questions and who you're talking to. You know, I mean, it always has an impact. But
yeah.
I do think – I don't know how they can moderate Paul Brown. I mean, I just don't know how you do that.
That's got to be the plan. I mean, that's what those people ought to be getting paid money to do, is to try to –
Yeah, but I don't know how you do that. I mean, he is
– I mean, I don't know either. But
he is wackadoodle out there.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
I can see – you might be able to do it with – you know, you could certainly do it with Kingston. You might be able to do it with
Gingrey.
I was thinking of that.
Perdue, I think you could do it pretty easily with. Handel,
oh, yeah, Perdue, I think Perdue
four-way.
Is pretty moderate, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can emphasize the business stuff. And then I think Handel, if you take away that plan, what was that, the Susan Coleman situation she had, I think there was too much of that to completely sweep that under the rug. But if you look at her career before that, I think you could moderate her. But then she used that to, I guess, establish some Tea Party right-wing street cred that she thought she'd need And that's going to kind of, I guess, come back to bite her a little bit. But, I mean, to the extent, not as badly as I think Paul Brown's crazy statements will come back to bite him.
Exactly.
So,
I think that Paul Brown is the crazier of the bunch. But that's,
yeah.
You know, the red meat for the Tea Party and the Republican base. That's what they want. And
yeah.
I just don't know how you can mitigate that, you know, how you can remediate that in an effective way to get, and again, I think if they do debates or even just, you know, television commercials and the visuals of Michelle Nunn, a young, enthusiastic, energetic woman with a very moderate, you know, hardworking background, working for a, you know, nonprofit that was, you know, by no stretch of, no, was not partisan, was very, really conservative in many ways. I think that I think that's going to be really hard for a Paul Brown to fight back against. I think that, you know, that's just my take.
Yeah, I do think the visual contrast that you mentioned with Jason Carter and Nathan Deal is much more stark and a better advantage to the Democrats than is the other matchup. And that's
right,
part of it. I think Paul Brown actually looks a little sunnier and younger. But I think I'll just be nice and say I think that contrast works better for Jason Carter. I think the message contrast of moderation and no crazy statements, that's going to work more for Michelle Nunn. So that's what she needs to focus on is more the substance. And I think Jason Carter obviously can focus on substance of, you know, education funding and things like that, too, and traffic planning and whatnot. Well, let's have one more topic, and this is totally like a speculation topic. But John King of CNN said that the Florida election results this past week is going to cause more, maybe a few more House Democrats that are in tough elections to decide not to run. Like if Alex Sink can't win that Tampa election, I ain't winning my election. Catherine, have you heard any names yet?
No. I think he made
that
up. Yeah,
I hadn't. Hey, maybe he did. That's why I wanted David Martin to be on the show, and I'm going to figure out what's going on there. And David's always been so consistent. I'm sure he'll make it up to us soon. But that's why I figured David, you know, he used to work in Washington, live there. Maybe he would just say, oh, yeah, it's Congresswoman so-and-so and Congressman so-and-so are thinking about calling it quits. I mean, here's the trick. There's so few swing districts anymore. You almost could look at the election results. And, of course, that brings me to think, you know, what about John Barrow here in our state of Georgia, although he's the kind of guy that never seems to shy from a fight, even though he always has a tough election, he never seems to be scared of it. So I don't think he would be the first one I go towards. But I guess if you started looking at places, you'd look at those swing district.
Well, John Barrow already qualified, so hopefully
he's
not going to.
So I guess that's another, Catherine, excellent tip. If you look at states where they have not yet qualified, that would be another telling sign. If your state's already had qualifying, like North Carolina, like Georgia, and the people have already qualified, that's probably a dead tip. They're sticking with it. So excellent. See, you did know more than you thought. Yep. So there's
well,
your whole
the elections
for
are.
Everybody.
I mean, the elections should be earlier, pretty much around the country because of this requirement about mail-in votes.
Yeah.
That's why ours is earlier.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know Florida has those September. They used to have those September primaries. So I'm not sure that some other states have later ones. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with that. Well, Catherine, I think it's been a great show. Brian, thanks for calling in, and thanks, everybody, for listening to the Kudzu Vine.
Good night.
Good evening.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And there essential love of justice.